together in a unique annual showcase.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Millennial 2022, called Millennial 8 in some places. I'm not quite sure on the title, but it doesn't really matter now. So I'm glad everyone's I'm glad that this seems to be working OK, at least initially. There have been a few technical screw ups already. My computer, some of you will know, was crashing a lot. I've got a new one just in case that's needed throughout the thing. It probably will be. And that's also been used for rendering and so on. Also, I was ill a bit, so that screwed up some of the things as well. So there have been hiccups. But I'm sorry about the countdown clock as well. Various things. However, nothing that really matters. The show is continuing, it's going to go on, and there are going to be 63 interviews this year, as well as five AMAs, but the first one was last night. So I've no reason to believe that it's going to be anything other than a good time, and I hope it will be, and I hope that you all enjoy it. Just one last thing, I'm using my webcam tonight, but tomorrow thereafter I'll be using the proper camera. So the image quality is and the camera position is not optimal, but don't worry, that will be solved tomorrow. So this is the first night, and this is the first stream, and it is with White Papers. So, all right, let's get on with it. And as I said, I hope that you all have a good time this year. I know that a lot of people have been looking forward to it. So here we go. All right. Oh, excellent. Okay. Hello, White Papers. And I'm. Can you speak?
Hello, Carlin.
Excellent. Hello. And how should I address you on screen? I'm not sure.
You can say White Papers, or you can call me James. Either works.
Okay. White Papers is obviously plural, but then so is Woes. So that's why it always sounded strange. You know, I didn't intend to be addressed as Woes. So
indeed.
It was just supposed to be the channel name. So you've probably experienced a similar thing. Before we get into what we're going to do mainly here is discuss the year's events, a sort of general overview, and obviously you can give your own commentary on each thing. But before we do that, why don't you briefly tell people what White Papers is and where they can find it? Well, I mean, the links are there, but go ahead and explain it to people.
Yeah, absolutely. So originally in April of 2020, I launched a website that focused on commenting on policy from the perspective of nationalism. That website has since been removed and is being overhauled. And I moved on to Telegram in February of this year, 2022. And mostly at the moment, it's just commentary on political events, on policy, again, from our perspective. Another really popular thing is the platform reviews. So myself and two other people who help out, we take the platforms of parties like the NJP or of Patriotic Alternative, and we review them, going over existing law and how they could be implemented. It's basically just to give people a roadmap to understand that our ideas aren't merely ideas, but they're actually practicable and could be implemented should we be given the opportunity. Really, it's just kind of an expansion on the political. If
sorry, hold on. I'm just trying to work out if this stream is actually going out on Odyssey. Gadius says, "Hey, folks, hello, Gadius, and thank you for helping out as you did last year." He's a mod on the live chat. Okay, we've got this seems a bit, I'm not quite sure if this is, right, okay, it is going
I
out.
I see it.
And yeah, it's there. Okay, we've got a few viewers, but not as many as I would expect. Yeah, we are live, Charlemagne's there. Okay, all right, okay, it seems that we're doing okay. All right, so sorry about that. I was distracted there trying to work out if there'd been some dreadful technical screw up. Okay, it seems to be all right. So, okay. Right. Sorry about that, James.
No problem. I've just put something out on my own channel.
Yeah.
People may have forgotten. It's only, goodness, I think it's only 3 in the afternoon in America, so.
Of course. Yeah, the time zones thing is a nightmare. It's so difficult to advertise this stuff because you don't know which time zone to advertise it in. It's an absurd thing about this stuff. Okay, so white papers, I mean, I described it as a news outlet. Would you say that's fair? I mean, see, obviously,
it's not inaccurate. We don't write original news. It's not, my goal is not reporting per se, but I offer perspective on, namely, policy developments. Occasionally, something will really get my goat, and it won't be policy related, and I'll have to say so. So I wrote about Zelensky being named the most powerful person in Europe, which that has nothing to do with policy, but it got my goat, and I just had to say something. So news isn't inaccurate; it's just not spot on. I was
right. Okay. And there is a focus on on European news rather than American, even though you do have a connection to America yourself.
Yeah, I occasionally put stuff up about the United States, but most of what you'll find is Europe.
Speaking in general, just on that note, would you say that America is less important? I mean, this is a ridiculously broad question to ask and to start with, but might as well go for it. Would you say that America is less of the hegemon, less of the hyperpower than it was, say, 5 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm going to toot my own horn here. We've known each other for Lord knows 8 years now. Something. It's been a long time. I can't even remember. And
yeah, it's amazing.
I remember commenting back in 2014 or 2015 in one of your old Skype chats that in 12 or 15 years, the United States would be looking down the barrel of the end of its ability to project power internationally, as it had to refocus on domestic issues. And it's 2022, and here we are, kind of looking down the barrel of the imminent collapse of what I view as the beginning of the imminent collapse of American hegemony. So it's been very interesting.
Why do you think America is, would you say it's accurate to say that America is collapsing? Or American hegemony?
I mean, why do I think? Well, the war in Ukraine really kind of laid it bare. We'll use India as an example. America has been threatening to sanction India over buying Russian weaponry for years now. And America leveled that threat again right when the war started to attempt and get everyone on their side. And the Indians, during a state visit to America, the Indian foreign minister said, well, then just do it. I don't care. Like, just do what you're going to do. We're buying Russian weapons. We're buying Russian oil. You do your worst. We're just going to do what we do. That's a remarkable change of behavior.
Absolutely.
To be that disrespectful to the hegemon. And it's not just India. I mean, even the Saudis and the Iranians have opened a dialogue with each other as they watch America and Europe flounder around like a salmon out of the river. So it's just displayed behavior more than anything.
Well, the thing, what about Afghanistan? I mean, that seemed to me like you might suspect, and I did suspect, that America was falling apart, so that's sort of decaying. And indeed, when I was there in 2016, there was a sense of decay. I mean, the city
physically, it's decaying. Yeah.
And it seemed significant then. It felt like that's not something you can ignore when it's supposed to be the hyperpower, and you go there, and the subway systems are dilapidated. The streets are full of junkies and hobos. The tarmac and the road is cracking and all that. That it's an ominous sign. But a far bigger sign for me was 2021 with the Afghanistan withdrawal. I mean, I thought that this just feels like, this doesn't feel like the behavior of a superpower, a hyperpower, or even just a confident country. To just sort of withdraw and leave it to the winds of fate. What would you say about the Afghanistan withdrawal?
You know, that was so fascinating and complex, because a lot of what Joe Biden does, to the extent he's conscious of anything he does, which is a question in itself, a lot of what Joe Biden has been doing is finishing up promises and following up promises which Obama made in office and never followed through on, and which Hillary Clinton made and was never able to follow through on. And Afghanistan was one of those. Obama had promised to pull out of Afghanistan. Hillary Clinton had made noises about wanting to get out of Afghanistan. And I think Joe Biden thought, you know, oh, I'm going to do it. If he thought, well, I'm going to get it done. I'm going to be the president who finally accomplishes this. He probably, you know, gave an order, told them, get it done. I don't care what you have to do, what you have to do to get it done. And you have a bloated, incompetent U.S. military that can't figure out how to get toilets to flush on aircraft carriers. And I'm not joking about that, let alone, you know, pull out tens of thousands of troops and tens of thousands of civilians from Afghanistan. It doesn't have the capacity to make these decisions anymore, and carry them out in the logical manner.
Well, the key manifestation of this surely is all the LGBT feminist stuff that they were trying to impose on the Afghanis.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that is just incredible. It's like this is a power that is no longer, I mean, that's not a mistake that you make by accident, and it's not a mistake that doesn't matter either. It's a mistake that does matter, and that happens through the nonsense of your own thinking. Like, in other words, this is what the American administration thought it should be doing in Afghanistan. It should be teaching the Taliban about, you know, transsexualism and whatever. That's absolutely clueless in a way that you can hardly fathom. And yet that is what they were doing. I mean, they had the, you know, LGBT pride and all that stuff going on. And I think BLM and George Floyd as well, actually. And apparently all of that was just wiped out within a few weeks of the American withdrawal, of course, because America had been there for 20 years, but none of that was ever going to stick. As soon as America was out, all of that was going to be undone, and it happened almost instantaneously.
Well, yeah, they would pull the... one of the eternal thorns in the side of America is they would pull the Afghans in the areas they controlled, and 63% of them would be in favor of Taliban rule. And it was very consistent that whole time. It was never a country where they won hearts and minds.
But of course, the America that invaded Afghanistan in what was that, 2003, is a different... No, it was 2000. I think it was 2002. Afghanistan. Was it actually within 2001 that they? Yeah. Well, it was Afghanistan first, and then Iraq. So, but the point I was going to make was that
that's 2001.
Yeah, the America that invaded Afghanistan is really not the same America that we know today. It's, you know, during that time, while the 63% consistently polled that they want the Taliban back, the invading colonizing force was becoming ever more crazy. I mean, you start with the George W. Bush, we're giving you freedom, you ungrateful, you know, Arabs. You start with that, and you end with some mulatto, transsexual, lesbian woman saying, you know, you've all, this is a, you should all be like me. It's a completely, like, radically different thing in the space of, what, just 20 years. That's, I mean, imagine being colonized and then the colonizer, it's not enough that he's colonized you. He then also goes slowly insane. That seems to have been, that's probably the experience that the Afghanis have had over the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah, it's the global perception. So in my university courses, it's very entertaining. The only people who agree with me on anything are the students from Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and, you know, someone will make a comment in favor of traditional marriage, and I'll be the only white person who agrees. And they all agree, and it's really remarkable to see how vast the disconnect has become between the Western world and the rest of humanity. The rest of humanity has no interest in 9-year-old pole dancing transsexuals. You'll never be able to convince them of that, even though America remains fixated on this idea.
Well, I mean, the West had absolutely no interest in that kind of thing 10, 15 years ago.
This not is really, the public.
No, the public, indeed. You know, this is really something that's, well, I mean, we don't need to go into that topic here, but it's something that's really happened over the last, you know, over the last decade and a half. I mean, people will remember about gay marriage not even being on the cards, and then suddenly it was an inevitability, and then it had been implemented. You know, it's remarkable how fast this has happened. But no, I'm not saying, by the way, that all of this, the degeneracy is entirely confined to the last 15 years. Obviously, it's not. But still, there has been a quantum leap.
Well, I think
Obama.
My quick opinion on that is, particularly in the realm of the Anglosphere, Ireland, America, Britain, et cetera, they kept trying to put this stuff to a vote, and they kept losing. Not a single American state ever voted for gay marriage, for example. They would put it on the ballot and it would fail. It failed in California, for Christ's sake, in like 2008. And I think finally the people who rule us gained enough institutional power that they said, well, we don't give a shit what you actually think. We're done with the voting. We're done with any sort of pretense. This is what we're doing. You have to live with it. And they've ramped it up since then. I mean, look, think about how much worse America got after Donald Trump was elected. And I don't mean that Donald Trump was responsible for this, but the drag queen story hour thing is an example. That really only kicked off after 2016. Then you started to see it everywhere in public libraries and schools and, you know, downtown. The institutional response to the election of Donald Trump was, well, okay, you can have Donald Trump, but we're just going to make it more gay. Ha ha.
Yeah, well, this is a thing that I noticed. And I actually read a book once about Melanie Phillips. I think you're familiar with her as a public figure. She's an English Jewish conservative woman. Anyway, she wrote this book about education in Britain. And one of the, she was talking about the history of it, really from the late 19th century through to about 2000. And one of the points she made in it is that one of the most drastic phases of evolution in British education was the 1980s. And that was when the left really took it over in a way that, like, completely secured total dominance over the education sector in Britain, especially at the schools. But the thing is that during that entire decade, Britain was under a so-called hard right government, the Tories, the Thatcherite Conservative Party. So how was it that this hard right government, right underneath them, this takeover of a key sector is going on? And they don't stop it. And the point I'm making here is, I think a similar thing happened. I mean, I think basically the left is constant. And if we're using, that seems like a bit of an antiquated term at this point, but I'll just use it for brevity. I think the left is expert at advancing its agenda, advancing its hold over different sectors both publicly and in a clandestine way as well. So when the government is right wing, the left is taking over other sectors. And then when the government is left wing, then it just it does it in a big way as well. But the point is that the government being right wing isn't really much of an obstacle for the left.
No, not at all.
I mean, it was under the Tories, and you can say, well, the Conservatives and the GOP, they're with the left on social issues, but that's true. But that's not the point that I'm making. The point I'm making is that the left is constantly colonizing society and taking it over. And I think that a similar thing, like 80s in America, in Britain with the education sector, similar thing happened in America throughout the Trump era. So you've got this supposedly hard right president, and yeah, he was a nationalist, in his own way, in his own milquetoast, naive boomer way, he was a nationalist. And yet, while he was the president, Charlottesville happened, BLM and George Floyd happened, various things, the whole LGBT thing really ramped up. America transformed leftwards while there was a right-wing president in the White House. I mean, it's a bizarre thing, isn't it?
Well, the left is, this is some really antiquated terminology, but it's a progressive movement in the sense that it is always progressing. They are never stopping. It is always on to the next frontier, doing whatever it takes, rather, to get into the next institution and to push the next agenda. The right is always fighting a rearguard action. And when they get into sort of close combat, the right just retreats. It just runs away. Literally, Donald Trump hid in the basement of the White House while Washington, D.C. was in flames. You can't get a better picture of what conservatism is.
There was the famous meme of him checking his phone while behind him it's all like an inferno.
Oh, yeah. The drawing, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yes, exactly. It was one of these... Not Ben Garrison, but it was that kind of thing, yeah. And it was a good one, and it was like just monitoring the situation kind of thing. This is why the terminology sort of calling it the left isn't right at this point, because on the one hand it is the left, but on the other it's a certain tribe. And at the same time, it's also globalists, like really globalists, not tribal. It's the whole UN, the whole.
Well, I call it. I just kind of put it all under the umbrella of neoliberalism. It's the neoliberal elite. Now, I understand some people don't like that term, and it's a bit of a fraught term. However, neoliberalism is an actual identifiable collection of ideas, and that is in general the system that we have to deal with. When we came out of the Second World War and all of these institutions were set up, they were set up by these neoliberal personalities in the U.S. State Department and in Brussels and in London. It's baked into the cake. So it doesn't really matter if they're a Tory or Labour or CDU or CSU in Germany. It's baked into the institutional cake. You can't escape it.
Absolutely. The CSU in Germany, I recall that's Merkel's party, and yet she... Mm. I mean, you could never say that it was conservative to bring in... and I'm not... I shouldn't laugh. This is deadly fucking serious stuff. You could never say it's conservative to bring in 2 million... foreigners into your country from any of any origins, but certainly not, you know, African and Middle Eastern. I mean, that is, I think our ancestors just a couple of generations ago would have seen that as the absolute diametric opposite of being a conservative or of conserving a country, to implement a change that drastic. And yet that is the CSU in Germany today. But of course, I'm in no way mocking them or mocking the Germans, because the British Conservative Party is just as bad. It brought in 1 million foreigners last year, without
that's just the legal number.
Yeah, exactly. Without even the excuse of there's a migrant crisis going on, you know, at least you can say Merkel had that pathetic excuse back in 2015. But the Tories in Britain today don't have that excuse. So anyway, I'm talking too much.
I think part of this is every conservative party in the West has adopted that old Tory saying, which is Tory conservatism anyway, isn't an idea. It's a mindset. It's a worldview. They don't claim it's, and it isn't an ideology. They're correct. And I think that's just been exported to continental Europe and frankly, across the world to some degree. None of these conservative parties actually care about any sort of principled conservatism. They just label themselves as a conservative, and it's kind of a personality type. Jacob Rees-Mogg, but global.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Daniel Hannan?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, God. Yeah, okay, then. Let's not get into that, then. That's a rather ugly tangent, but he's one of these... it doesn't matter. Okay, so let's talk about the year's events, since that is what we thought would be a good way to open Millennial. And you drew up a list of what you regard as the key political events in Britain, Europe throughout 2022. Unless there's anything else you'd like to say about conservatism as a mindset before we get into that.
No, I don't think so. I will remind you, as we talked about before we started, there are some other events like Canada we should remember to cover.
I've added them to the
fantastic
notes. So, all right. So the first, okay. I want you to just give the audience more of a flavor of you as a commentator. I want you to characterize 2020 and 2021. And then 2022. So 2020 first. How would you characterize that as a year?
A grind. It was grinding. It was kind of soul crushing in a way. And for me, that's a bit of a unique statement because obviously, where I live, we didn't. And I live in Sweden. I've not hidden that from my audience. There were no lockdowns here. There were no mask mandate. I mean, my life continued virtually unaltered in any way. I lived and still live in a decent sized city, and I went about my days, and I'm watching the rest of the world go mad. It was the most remarkable thing.
Got photos of London from the first few days of the lockdown, and it's like a ghost city. It was just bizarre. Something I'll never forget.
I took a trip to America in, well, yeah, it would have been December of 2020. And, you know, landing in a major city in a major airport, there was no one. I mean, on the plane, when I flew, however many rows there are on a plane, I don't know. Let's just say there are 70 from front to back. There was one person in each row across the whole plane. So there are, I don't know, 12 seats. And I'm the only person in this row.
And it's like post-apocalyptic stuff. I remember taking a train journey across London, overground train, and I was the only person in the carriage, you know, and it was kind of fun. I wouldn't deny it. It was definitely...
Oh, I know. I got to sleep on the plane.
that kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. It's not like normal life. It's that sense of things being in a different mode.
No, it definitely messed people up, though.
Yeah,
a memory I never forget is flying back to Sweden, and we left Amsterdam and we're flying back and we hit Swedish airspace. Everyone who lives here, we all took our masks off. You heard the Swedish sigh. We're like, oh God, okay, that's done. And all the other people, you know, this is still in 2020. All the other people on the plane are like, what the fuck are you people doing? Like, what? That's illegal. You know, they had this like freaked out animal look in their eye. They couldn't believe it. And we're all like, oh Christ, finally done with that. It messed a lot of people up.
Well, that was an interesting aspect of COVID, that it created a new division in society that simply had not existed before. You know, you had gays versus straights, blacks versus whites, left wingers versus right wingers, religious versus atheists, Catholic versus Protestants, all of this kind of thing, Muslims versus infidels, all of that kind of thing. And then suddenly you had vaccinated versus unvaccinated, and the people who wore masks and the people who disgustingly didn't wear masks, etc. A new division in society that still I don't really think has fully gone away. I mean, it's now like, do you believe in this stuff or not? Are you a sane, sensible, responsible member of society or not? And indeed, the World Economic Forum seemed to allude to this when they talked about 2020 and COVID as the great test of social responsibility. You know, they're thinking of it in those terms, as there are the people who do the right thing and there are the people who we might well put into concentration camps or something in the future. And, you know, that sounds like an exaggeration and laughable. But in Canada and Australia, they were prepared. And they did have those things. I mean, it's I don't think it's surprising at all that people were getting very scared and very nervous about all of that stuff, and that there was a sense of something profound going on. Because I don't want to ally you with any of these thoughts, because I'm pretty sure you had a different perception of it all. But certainly for me, it felt like a new age was beginning. And I think they did want it that way.
Well, I would say and you're right, I don't comment on COVID very often. It's just not an issue that particularly piques my interest. However, I will say, it was very plain and simple that adherence to whatever dictate was made by whatever scientist was put on television became a social test. And I think it started a new paradigm where now adhering to anything that's put in front of the general public on television by someone who is labeled credible or an expert is now a new social test. I mean, we're seeing that with the war in Ukraine. The war in Ukraine, Russia is evil, and it doesn't matter what my personal take on this is, but Russia is evil. If you disagree, you fail the test.
Oh, absolutely. This is the whole thing about there is one opinion that you're allowed on every social issue, and it's mandatory. It's not that you're allowed that opinion.
You have to pass the test.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that certainly wasn't the case in the 90s or even the 2000s a bit. I mean, it was creeping in then. Probably an older person would say, no, it was creeping in a long time before the 2000s. But for me, it was the 90s is sort of like the default. It's the baseline. And this mentality started to creep in the 2000s. Like, for example, in 2005, you couldn't say, like a normal person in a normal mainstream part of society could not say, but I think it's all right to be racist. Whatever, who cares? Everyone's allowed their own opinion. That was not allowed anymore. And then it increased in the 2010s with the whole SJW stuff and what we now call wokery. And now this, with in the 2020s, COVID, climate change, and Ukraine. Really, every current topic, there is a prescribed opinion, a mandated opinion. Which is a very new way to live.
Well, I think this is because there are no fundamentals which hold society together. We don't agree on what marriage is. We don't agree on what a man and a woman is. We don't agree on what a family is. We can't even agree on what a nation state. Every fundamental presumption that humans have made for the vast majority of our history is just completely gone, and so they have to use social mechanisms to enforce adherence to whatever the current shit test is.
yeah, it's a very, I mean, maybe it is because the society is just not organic as it used to be. It's now very much a sort of artificial project that needs artificial sustenance. And
That's why it's doomed to fail.
Mm. Okay, well, let's get to the year's events. I mean, we could, or at least 2020, 2021, would like anything to say about that? Just as a year?
It was kind of the transition. I think COVID as a noticeable everyday part of our lives came to an end. Well, for you guys, not, again, not for me, but for the rest of the world, I would say it was sort of your transition out of sort of in-your-face COVID-related living when you go to the shops and stuff like that. And I think just as things were really beginning to feel in sort of a way normal again, then we had 2022 and the war between Russia and Ukraine. So we didn't even get like 3 months reprieve.
Oh yeah, exactly. One thing we could have mentioned is at the end of 2020 is the US election, because I think that was another thing.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, exactly. But that was another thing that I would say really marked the end of an era, because it was just so blatantly corrupt and unbelievable, implausible, that it seemed to, you know, to me anyway, that it seemed like they're not even trying to make that. I mean, what would you say about that?
I am not necessarily convinced. No, so I take the I'll say this. I take the Ann Coulter position, which is, they always cheat. They've cheated for decades now, and no one should be surprised by the cheating. You know, Trump's own campaign postmortem really sort of dug into the demographic he failed to grasp. I will, however, say this. What the 2020 election did, or what it represented, was a watershed in that American democracy will never, ever be stable again. Every election is now dominated by questions of legitimacy, and that will only get worse. It won't get better. I mean, now we see individual states have questions about the legitimacy of elections, right down to the county water officials. I think this was literally an issue in like Wyoming or something. So American democracy is just coming apart.
Yeah. And then, as you say, all of it was sort of unraveling and calming down. Except in Canada, where there was the trucker protest going on, but we'll get to that. And then Ukraine,
remarkable fury.
Yeah, we'll get to that. And then the Ukraine thing started. So okay, let's get to the year's events. And the first one you mentioned is on the 30th of January 2022, and it was the Portuguese legislative election. So would you like to talk about that?
Right. Jay? So I think the reason I put this down here as sort of the opener was that it cemented a trend that the political class in Europe is worried about, which is the national conservative parties, you know, the Judeo-Christian people who care about the nuclear family but don't quite align with our politics, which in Portugal is Chega, I think is how it's pronounced. They increased their vote by sevenfold. So this kind of, for the whole year, cemented this trend of these far right, I don't like that term, but far right political parties beginning to gain ground.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, obviously we'll get to Italy later in the year. But would you like to just go into that about Portugal a wee bit? Because people, you know, it's not the most prominent country in Europe, so a lot of people won't know about this. So would you like to go into it?
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot to say. You know, the Portuguese, they're kind of like Ireland. Their prime minister is Indian, as in India. They had to go through quite a bit of COVID nonsense, and their ruling class is still kind of big on that. The whole preparing for the next pandemic thing, which is wording I always find remarkably ominous. you kind of had Chega, which challenged the only political party in the country, similar to Meloni in Italy. They were the only ones who didn't go along with every single narrative presented by the ruling class, and they were rewarded for that. And it, again, it cemented this trend of whatever guy was actually doing even the most minimum protest against sort of the unified neoliberal consensus won.
Right. Okay. So someone's just pointed out, because you said that Ireland has an Indian prime minister, someone just pointed out.
Not yet. He's going to be in a couple of months or something.
Right. But someone just pointed out about Britain. I hadn't even occurred to me.
Jeez.
But, yeah. But we'll get to that in due course. All right. So then the next, well, and then in January also, fairly sure it was towards the end of January, the Canadian trucker convoy happened, which was a fairly big thing. I mean, it was a huge story for us at the time. The mainstream media ignored it for as long as they possibly could. I'll be talking about this in much more detail later, later with the course of Empire. But it was a big story. Mainstream tried to bury it. It lasted about, what, a month, 6 weeks, something like that, before the Trudeau government really clamped down on it. Apparently, because under the encouragement of Biden, of all people. And this was about COVID. This was like the last chapter in the main COVID story, so to speak. COVID as a saga.
I mean, it's in sort of the book of COVID. Ultimately, I don't think what the truckers were doing, the Canadian state's reaction to the truckers, I don't think was ultimately motivated by COVID itself, but was ultimately motivated by the state doggedly insistent that these people do whatever it tells them to do. And I think that, you know, it sort of disabused a lot of people of the illusion that a liberal state sort of has to take the indirect circuitous route to get people back into line. I mean, the Trudeau government invoked every piece of emergency legislation that existed in Canada. They blatantly seized assets and money, threw people into jail without warrants or cause. I mean, it was a remarkable display of what the state is willing to do to its political opponents. And to some degree, that was almost, I don't want to say a good thing, but it disabused people a lot of illusions that the liberal state sort of has to adhere to the own rules it set for itself. It absolutely does not.
Yeah, because there is no longer any organ in society that's holding the state to account. You know, the media just doesn't do it. It's completely.
Well, the media exit on.
Exactly. It's the very opposite of what it should be doing, holding the feet to the fire and all that, questioning decisions. None of that, again, this is to do with the consensus building machinery that we now seem to have. Part of that is that the media and the government, almost whichever government you're talking about, all the governments are in lockstep, and then the media are in lockstep with the government, and the corporations are in lockstep, and everything. And it's a very, as I said, it's a very new way to live, you know, in the West. It's a very new situation that has emerged or materialized over the last 10, 15 years. And again, there's a lot that could be said about that, but we'll not get into that just now. But it was this. What was so scary about it, especially in Canada, was there were clearly a lot of people who were opposed. And I agree with you that it wasn't really about COVID. It was about the government using COVID to implement control over the public, to wield power. And this particularly affected the truckers. They had to get the vax passed and all that, which meant that they had to get vaccinated. And so they rebelled. But the rebellion was really against the heavy-handed state authority. And I'm not sure. What was so scary about it was, so the truckers do this convoy, this protest, but there was so little organization, you know, there was so little professionalism. And I'm not saying this to besmirch the truckers or the organizers of that in any way. I'm just saying it's interesting how to contrast the formal power structures and the professionals, the people who know what they're doing and how to do things like that with amateurs. Because, for example, information isn't even pulled. You know, nothing is formalized. Nothing is streamlined. Everything is shambolic. And this was throughout COVID, not just in Canada. It was everything. When you're up against the mainstream, as a lot of people suddenly found themselves, you realize how bad we actually are at opposing the mainstream, at organizing against them. Because without a power structure in place, everyone just sort of faffs around and randomly. And it's very difficult for things to get, well, for anything to get done. And that was a depressing thing with it. Sorry, go on.
The working class doesn't have an previously, the working class had the unions, and it had social clubs and sort of these various institutions of the demos, which represented them. And, you know, initially the truckers did turn to their union. And of course, unions are no longer staffed by workers. Unions are staffed by people with prestigious, in quotation marks, university degrees, who just agree with every assumption, with every ideological assumption of the same people in the halls of power. So when the truckers turned to their union said, "Oh no, you're gonna do exactly as the Liberal government says." So it's just a fact that working class people don't have any institutions around which to organize, and in a situation like that, it is shambolic.
Yeah, and I don't want to target the working class or even the truckers specifically. My comment was about everything. Yeah. My comment was about all opposition to COVID. You know, there was just, because you realize that the people, and I've seen this myself in our movement, that the people who are good at organizing are generally in the mainstream organizing. And that's why we don't have that. You know, and I'm not saying that there are no good, of course there are good organizers, but the point is that the people who are do it for a living are doing it for a living. And so the people who are left to do it in opposition to the mainstream, it's just not the same thing. And this goes for really almost every sector, whether it, you know, organizing, funding, media, graphics, etc. The World Economic Forum, for example, has the resources to just do whatever the fuck, like anything, and it will be done at world-class quality level. Whereas everyone else, when you're actually up against things like that, when you're the opposition, it's a very different thing. Now, what you would hope is, well, as the mainstream becomes ever more unreasonable, as it certainly is going to, more and more people will decamp from the mainstream into the opposition, into the dissident sphere.
Only if we can pay them a salary.
Well, that's the issue. Okay, so let's move forwards, unless there's anything else you'd like to say about the Canadian convoy.
No, nothing that immediately comes to mind.
Okay.
No, I don't believe so.
All right. And then the next event is on the 4th of February, and this obviously lays the groundwork for the key event of this year. Sino-Russia declaration against NATO expansion on the 4th of February.
Yeah, so the Russians and the Chinese came out and they issued this really kind of grand joint declaration, sort of. It did two things. Number one, it explicitly came out against expanding NATO and sort of told the West that it had to stick to its promises to not expand NATO, and I can get more into that later. And then it also demanded that the Western nations adhere to the sort of multilateral institutional framework that we talked about earlier that they set up in the aftermath of the Second World War. So we're talking about the UN and we're talking about the World Trade Organization and all of these bodies, which China and Russia also participate in. Part of the issue that states like China and Russia have in these institutions is that they're super hard to reform because you have to get everyone on board, and Western states generally have a complete monopoly. So it stops virtually the entire rest of the world from getting any utility out of them. An example is the IMF. The United States its vote is weighed so heavily in the treaties, it can veto anything. It can veto absolutely everything, even if 80% of the countries of the world agree on issuing new SDRs to deal with, you know, a liquidity crunch or something. America can just say, oh, no, we're not doing that. I don't care what you know. So, you know, China and Russia are trying to say, well, if we're going to participate in these institutions, you have to act in good faith. And of course, America's response was no.
Yes, indeed. Well, as I said, this lays the groundwork. It's like a sort of prelude to what happened next. And that was only 20 days later, actually. Yeah. The 24th of February, Russia invades Ukraine. So I'll give you the pleasure of introducing that whole big saga.
I was awake talking to a friend of mine. And I remember seeing the first, like, on Telegram, you know, all those breaking news. What are they called? Anyway, those internet intelligence channels.
Disclose that kind of thing.
And I remember seeing the video of the Ukrainian soldiers fleeing the border post. And I just knew immediately, like, oh, okay, well, here we go. The invasion has begun. I knew immediately. It was no mystery that it was going to happen the previous day when all those airspace blocks were closed along the border. I mean, it didn't take a genius to know it was coming, even as
you know,
Zelensky was saying, no, everyone calm down. It was so obvious.
Yeah. I remember maybe 2 weeks before it started, there was the first sort of rumor that it's going to happen. Russia's going to invade Ukraine. And there was footage of tanks being transported across Russia towards the border. And also Ukraine, if I speak about it as an entity, didn't seem to take the prospect very seriously. And I remember that, I think it was the Ukrainian, I don't know what it would be called, but they're like the Home Office, the equivalent of that. And they tweeted something like, invade us if you're gay. Something like that. And I'm sure it was genuine. At the time, there was some sort of jokey thing that happened. Like, they just weren't taking it seriously. That there was, you know, Russia's not going to invade us. That's ridiculous. I don't know what it was, but something happened that I remember being like genuine. Maybe I just got fooled by this. Maybe it was some spoof Twitter profile. But
you have to remember that a key assumption of almost all modern political science is that, quite literally, this has been said by political scientists. It's made its way, and it's a famous quote: two countries which both have a McDonald's will never go to war. This is a key.
Right.
This is a key presumption of the current. It was a key presumption of the current order, and Russia said, "You can take away our McDonald's. We don't care," and we got a war. All of the elite in Ukraine are going to have operated from that assumption when they made that tweet. Like, no, war doesn't actually happen anymore, not in the traditional state-on-state way.
Well, that's a thing in itself, isn't it? That I think perhaps a lot of people thought that, you know, war with tanks and stuff and soldiers and guns and people being shot, that's like, that's something from the past. That just doesn't, of course, there's all, like, militarily, technologically, it's old hat, but then also culturally, well, you know, we're in the end of history. The Cold War's over, and
Francis Fukuyama.
Exactly. So war doesn't happen in the West. That's, and I think that was a sort of assumption that quite a lot of people had. But at the same time, I do think that this war was sort of goaded. And, well, okay, what would you say is the background to the Ukraine war?
Well, so, you know, there's always this quote about NATO promising Russia that it wouldn't expand, which it's correct to say that was never written down on paper, that there was never a signed agreement that said that. but Undersecretary of State James Baker had told the Soviets in the 80s or 90s, I think it was the 90s, just before the collapse of the Soviet Union, that no, it's not logical for NATO to expand beyond Germany. This doesn't make sense. We see no reason to do this. Now, of course, we're in NATO expanded right up to the Russian border and had Ukraine join NATO, which I do think was unlikely, but had it joined NATO, you know, heavy ordnance would have been in shooting distance of Moscow. And Russia is one giant flat open plain. It's the Central European plain. And Russia wins wars through having strategic depth. Retreat until you can mass enough men to slaughter the enemy. And NATO kept creeping closer, and Peter Hitchens has been pointing this out for decades and decades and decades. If we stop creeping closer to Russia, Russia will stop working itself into a panicked frenzy about this. How about we just back off? And NATO, nor any Western country at any point, was willing to do that.
Yeah. I mean, would you say that, because, well, okay, so why would you, in your view, why did NATO keep doing this, keep expanding, and, you know, why didn't Russia get the guarantees it wanted and so on?
Well, I think they were vexed. So if you remember, after the fall of the Soviet Union, particularly like 1998 to 2005, 6, 7, it was really this stark belief that Russia would liberalize and Russia would become like Western Europe. And there were these Western corporations which were buying up assets in Russia. And then you kind of got around 2007, 2008 when, I don't remember the exact trigger, but Putin was in office and everything started to sort of shift away from that. Russians were becoming increasingly unhappy with how Western corporations were behaving in their country. I mean, in Russia, and this has been, it's been this way for decades, the word democracy, like it's like demokratia, it's a dirty, it's an insult in Russia. It's a joke. To say something is democratic or somewhere is a democracy, it's an insult. It's meant to portray sort of incompetence and insolence and predation.
And good.
I would have to agree. And I think as it became increasingly clear that Russia was in fact not and never going to liberalize, the West just became increasingly hostile to a state which obviously wasn't going to adhere to its ideology.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting thing, because obviously the idea was the West is such a great, we have such a great way of living here, that obviously the Russians, now free of from the communist yoke, are going to gravitate towards our way of life. And I think probably in some ways they did. But at the same time, they could see the nonsense aspects about the way we live in the West, part of it being electoral corruption, as alluded to earlier. And just the general shittiness that democracy leads to, the shambolic nature of a society. And also the whole LGBT stuff, the whole mass immigration and diversity stuff. And I think they realized, in some sense, Russians thought, well, that we don't want that. So, and also we don't need, you know, usury, hardcore capitalism.
They weren't going to trade one predatory communist system for a predatory neoliberal one.
Exactly.
It just wasn't going to happen. They were getting a taste of it and they rejected us.
Yeah, yeah. So, but another, of course, that's, I guess we could talk about that, but let's keep it brief. Another aspect to it is more contentious, which is the Zionist aspect of Ukraine. I mean, what would you say about that? Because there are, I mean, let's be honest, there are a lot of Jews involved in Ukraine. And
it's basically it's another Jewish state. I mean,
yeah. Well, you take it away, but you know, obviously, be tactful.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how directly that played a role in Russia's decision. Because if anything, all that did was sort of reinforce Ukrainian ties to Brussels and Washington and London. I say Ukrainian very loosely. I don't know if that the presence of that particular group of people sped up or made inevitable the invasion in a way that it otherwise wouldn't have been. You could have like some curly haired mulatto woman as president of Ukraine, and I think we'd still be where we are.
Yes. Yes. I could see what you, yeah, I agree actually. But the truth is we don't have a curly haired mulatto woman, do we? it's Zelensky.
The most powerful man in Europe.
Yeah, well, yeah. Was he Time Magazine Man of the Year, or what was that? See, I see these things, and I don't know whether it's even real.
He's on the front page of all of them. He's taken the entire Man of the Year world by storm.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot that could be said about Ukraine, but I dare say it will be said across the span of millennia this year. So
I am definitely not in a position to talk about the minutiae of the war. You know, I don't know what weapon systems they're using or what hill they're fighting over currently, and I frankly don't care.
No, neither do I, actually. I mean, I don't want to go into that kind of detail. That's for other channels, but I'm interested in the, you know, geopolitical.
Yeah, exactly.
All that kind of stuff. What it all means in the end. Okay, so, yeah, and about Zelensky, I was going to say, you know, he just strikes me as... I mean, he even looks corrupt. He even looks untrustworthy. And I don't know whether that's a trivial point to make, a trivial thing to say. Maybe it is. But at the same time, gut instinct tends to be very useful. It tends to be correct. And I just wouldn't trust Vladimir Zelensky as far as I could throw him. He just seems like a... You know, used car salesman, and that's even without even getting into the whole thing about, and nothing against used car salesmen, by the way. That's without getting into the whole stuff about his fucking bizarre background with these. You see this stuff, you know, where he's wearing shiny latex shorts, and it's oh god,
it's all quite distasteful, just on sort of objectively very distasteful.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't even care about so much about it happening, you know, whatever. He's an entertainer, but he's not. He's a politician now. So this background is kind of bizarre, incongruous. But yeah, okay. There's a lot to say about that. All right, so let's move forwards from that to the next thing, which is, and this was... Actually, just 2 days later, Russia is removed from the SWIFT system. So,
yeah. So I put that on there because it sort of represents this fascinating connection to the joint declaration that we mentioned earlier, which is sort of Russia and China had come out and said, "Well, you know, if we have these truly neutral international institutions, then we demand that they actually behave in a neutral manner." And don't serve any one particular nation's interests. And then, of course, Russia is removed from SWIFT, which was sort of a confirmation of the fear from the declaration, because up until that point, SWIFT, which is actually technically a private corporation held by the banks who use it, had outright refused to remove people from it except for Iran, in conjunction with a deal that Iran had agreed to. It had refused to remove Russia in 2014. It had refused several times to remove Israel, naturally. And then finally, with the current war, it waded into the political, and it removed the Russians. And it sort of confirmed for the entire world that these institutions are not and cannot and will not be politically neutral. And I think, you know, we're going to see increasingly nations building bilateral and multilateral alternatives to things like SWIFT so that they don't get caught out again. I mean, the Chinese don't want to get cut off from banking.
I remember Morgoth at the time made a point. I don't know if it was about being removed from Swift. It might have been. But he made this point that in the space of 5 years, the regime, the Western regime, has gone from banning people from Twitter to deplatforming entire countries from the global financial system.
Yes, yes.
Exactly. And it's an interesting parallel as you're talking about Swift there, saying, oh, well, we would never ban, we would never remove. Well, you know, it isn't. And I know it's not the same thing. I'm not likening, and, you know, just in case anyone thinks that I'm likening my Twitter ban or something to, you know, Russia. Yeah. I'm not. I'm just, it's the principle is interesting, you know, that you go from this to, well, we can just, well, we can just deprive you of this service that everyone else has, and it's useful, and now you're going to be without it because you've been bad, you're a bad person, you've got bad ideas, and we all, the rest of us hate you. You're going to really have to get with the program if you want this service back. Now, you can do that with some disgruntled, you know, e-celeb, but to do it with a fucking country the size of Russia, to do it to a country is a different, and especially a country like Russia, is an altogether different matter. And yet, in the space of what, 5 years, you know, and it was unthinkable at one point to, you know, get banned from Twitter or whatever, YouTube. Then it's just de rigueur. And in the same way, it was unthinkable to that, you know, someone would get, a country would get removed from Swift. Now it's happening because that part of this is now how seriously we take the expectation that people will adhere to neoliberal ideas.
Yes.
If they don't, then, well, this is how seriously we take that.
You know, another parallel is on the same line is obviously the last several years now, people started to get, you would get banned from PayPal, and now they will outright in places like Britain, they'll close your bank account. And another thing that changed with this war was, you know, nations hold currency reserves. So when Russia holds, you know, $100 billion, that $100 billion isn't in Russia's banks. It's held in American banks, in the name of the Russian Federation. And the assumption since the end of the Second World War has always been that this is politically neutral. This is our money. You can't take our money. We won't take your money. Like this was the assumption that this is all, it's always operated on this platform. And then now the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, they've all frozen Russia's the currency reserves Russia held in their banks. They took their bank accounts away. That's just another parallel here. And again, to a sovereign state, that's like, who has been given assurances for decades that these are politically neutral functions every state is going to adhere to. Well, no, they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. The system is now very ideological, and when you become ideologically discordant with it, it is perfectly willing to punish you for that by just disqualifying you from its services. It is quite remarkable. In an age where people lose their bank accounts for having the wrong political ideas, it's not altogether surprising that a country, that this can happen to a country with Swift.
The difference is a country can build an alternative, it can literally open its own bank.
exactly. It actually, just start your own Swift.
Russia and China have both done that. There's now... Yeah. BRICS, that the Brazil, Russia,
India, and China.
Yeah. Countries are now applying to join BRICS because BRICS is going to build a Swift alternative for bank communication. Like, you know, countries can't just build another one. You can't kick them and then they'll stay down and they'll give in, especially on a country as big as Russia.
This is kind of like that saying about if you owe the bank £1,000, you've got a problem. If you owe them £1,000,000, the bank's got a problem. It's a similar thing here. If you ban one person from the financial system, the economic system, he's got a problem. But if it's a fucking country, then, well, now you've shot yourself in the foot. And this is something that is is really manifesting now with the energy shortages. The West seem to think we can punish Russia by disqualifying it from things, by removing it from things. But actually, that hurts the West.
Far more.
In some ways, maybe Russia more still, but in some ways, it's very painful for the West. And as I say, this is really manifesting.
You live in Britain. You pay energy bills. You are seeing the harm here.
Why do you think I've got this big fluffy shawl?
Yeah, no kidding, right? you are living with the consequences of a system trying to tell a very large sovereign state what to do that is under no obligation to acquiesce.
Precisely. So this option that the West thought would get this errant country under its control actually becomes something that alters life in the West, because that errant country just decides to say fuck you.
There's always someone else to sell your oil to. There's always someone else who will give you dollar. I mean, if Russia needs dollars for something, it could just go to the UAE and say, we'll give you some gold. You'll give us some dollars. Let's make a deal here. I mean, there's almost 200 countries in the world. It's not like what they did to Russia has kneecapped it in any significant way. Meanwhile, inflation in Europe is at 11%.
Exactly. And, that's an interesting point in itself, because we are told in the West that globalism, that the way we live, the system that we live under, globalism, is globalism. It's global. It's all over the world. But really, it's not. And this is something that, again, has been revealed by what's happened over this year with Ukraine and Russia. Russia does actually have other options, because there is a world beyond the West and beyond the petrodollar. That's interesting. It's significant. It's changing. It's having big repercussions for the West. I mean, Germany. Well, again, we'll get to that with other guests in the future streams. But is there anything else you'd like to say about this, James?
No, I don't think so. And I think we can probably skip over.
Well, the next one is, on the 8th of March, the EU begins phasing out Russian oil. And that's what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is a way to punish Russia, but it ends up just punishing ourselves.
It hurts us way more. Oh, my gosh. It's not even funny.
No, it's really not funny. I mean, this is, God, it's grim stuff. Okay, moving on. The 3rd of April, the Bucha massacre. Would you like to refresh people's memories about that?
Oh yeah, that was the massacre they claimed that Russia did, despite the fact that it happened while Russians were in the town. In Britain, I think it was Britain who blocked the investigation on that. The Russians called for an investigation, and the British government said, "No, we're good with the narrative." I think I put that on there because it was the first real manifestation of the fact that we're not going to get facts. We're just going to run with narratives for this war. Everything is a narrative.
Right.
It's a Russian or Western narrative, it's just a narrative.
Yes. And this, the whole Ghost of Kiev thing, was going on, and that quickly became a meme. And also there's that tranny. This is a whole other aspect of the, right. Okay. There's one other aspect I'll mention first, which is that Zelensky seems to have been, a brand has been manufactured with Zelensky as this wee pudgy guy who is always very serious, very forthright, earnest, and he's always wearing green or khaki colours. Almost never do you see him in anything else. And I find that it's interesting. It's like a brand. Where it's like a visual brand, where you see this guy and you instantly recognize him in a way that it didn't happen. I can't think of it happening with any other leader in my lifetime. And obviously you can say Trump with his red tie, but this is a wartime thing. this is a product or a let's say visual brand that's explicitly associated with a nation at war. So it's a way to grab your attention and your sympathy and your support. You want to support this guy. And here he is again, consistently, always wearing his army clothes.
The Ukrainian state hired American and European PR firms. I mean, they have private PR consultants there in the office. In fact, the European Union released a statement months ago, kind of pridefully talking about this. Europeans are helping to craft the global image of Ukraine in conflict. This is something I've been very honest about.
Yeah, right. Okay. Interesting. I didn't know that actually. Yep. And so that's, you've got this artificial product, this thing of Zelensky as that image, that person who appears all over the place, and even in hologram form.
Oh yeah, that was a French firm that was doing that.
Yeah, run by a South African Jew, incidentally. anyway, so the and then the next thing was the tranny. This is a bizarre, surreal aspect of the Ukraine thing. Where you've got this, I'm guessing it's a transgender American guy of Ukrainian descent, and he's got. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know about this, but I'm aware of several. I've seen.
How many tranny war correspondents are there?
Okay. I'm familiar with the war. I'm just thinking about. So, for example, I know there's a Ukrainian unit on social media, and their whole personality is that. A bunch of them in this unit are furries, you know, the people who dress up in, and then there's another one where the, their whole thing is, I'm sure you've heard the term femboy, like on their off time, they wear skirt. Like these people are all over this thing.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be a fucking war. I'm sorry. I keep swearing everyone, but it's just my indignation and outrage about this, is beyond compare. And it's just so strange that you've got this, it's a war zone, fighting, bombs, guns, and then there's this transgender guy, going, Slava Ukraina, and being very emotional and almost crying. And that's fake as well. I mean, I don't believe that's genuine.
No, definitely.
It just comes across as completely forced and fake. It's just such a strange thing. I mean, it doesn't feel like a war in any sense that we knew it before this. You know, and it's the same thing with famous, Bono, U2, went over there and did a concert in the army barracks. What? And then, of course, you've got Ben Stiller and other Hollywood celebrities.
Oh, anyone who's anyone is trying to get their way into the Ukrainian sphere.
Not Ben, is it Ben Stiller? I'm getting mixed up with someone else. There was somebody who gave his Oscar to Zelensky, and I've forgotten.
What?
Yeah. Well, from one actor to another. Sean Penn, that was
my
it.
My God, it was Sean Penn? Really?
Yeah. Nice. But I mean, quite a few actors have gone over there, and it's just so strange, you know? This is supposed to be a war. And then you've got the weird photo shoots off Zelensky where it doesn't even look real. It looks green screened. And I'm not saying it even is green screened. I'm just saying it looks like it. It's a strange thing. It all, someone said, it feels unusual because the conflict is mostly restricted to the East and Russia until very recently. Until very recently decided to handicap themselves in refusing to target electrical infrastructure. Right, okay, that's a good explanation.
That is part of it. The Russians have left the internet until recently. They left the internet on, they left the power on, they kept the plumbing going. I mean, the Russians weren't blowing up critical civilian infrastructure. Now they are.
Yeah, the new guy in charge. Okay, let's move ahead. So that's the Bucha massacre, and then on the 7th of April, the UN-EU global food shortage warning.
Yeah, the French were the first one, surprisingly, and we'll skip over the next one, by the way. I don't think it's important enough, but the French were the first people who really put out in April, they came out and they said, you know, countries are going to have trouble getting food. All of this food that comes out of Eastern Europe and even Western Europe with prices, there's going to be a global food shortage, and they're kind of dealing with this now. It's really complicated because you have to remember, food is not just something that's put on a ship and traded. It's also a financial commodity. There are people on Wall Street who trade food futures and shares, and they hold it in a warehouse to see how high the price will go. And they try to, I mean, it's a lot more than just selling a crate of apples from one country to another in a lot of these circumstances. In fact, there was a small famine in Africa in 2008 that they're very certain was caused not because there wasn't enough food, but because speculators were holding it in warehouses trying to get a better price. So we've got kind of a double whammy on this here, and they've sort of managed it for now, but it's still not very pretty.
Right. Okay. Then the next one is the 24th of April, the Slovenian elections, and Robert Golob becomes PM.
Yeah, I put that in there just for the sake of kind of congruity. I don't really think there was nothing significant about it that we need to address, other than sort of the, there was kind of hope that this signaled a change because the former prime minister had been kind of an Orban guy and he lost, but it didn't really signal any kind of change.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, okay. It's disappointing, isn't it? It just seems to be a fairly typical thing where you think someone always is a bit based and then it turns out to be a big damn squib. all right. Then the 27th of April, Russia halts gas flow to Poland and Bulgaria.
Yeah, this was sort of the first shot in the gas pipeline pseudo war. Obviously, then we had Yalta going to Germany was eventually shut down, and the Germans ended up shipping gas back east to Poland. I mean, it caused this whole huge shift in flows around Europe.
Right. Okay. I mean, obviously, that's become very significant recently, but let me see. Did you put the Nord Stream? I don't think you've got the Nord Stream.
I didn't.
Thing.
I forgot about it, which is funny because I was just reading okay. a report on that.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll find out when that was and I'll add it into the notes. And then the next one, the 9th of May, Council on the Future of Europe concludes.
Yeah, this is extremely interesting and it got very little attention. So for the last 2 years, the European Union has been running this sort of assembly of politicians and industrialists and quote-unquote average citizens who've been gathering in Brussels to go over proposals for the future of Europe and the future of the European Union and what shape everyone wants this to take. And of course, it was horribly rigged. Like most of the citizens that they invited to participate were from pro-EU groups. So you didn't have people with any kind of dissenting voice who were able to speak. And the politicians who participated, a big gripe was they never addressed citizen proposals. They just stood up and gave speeches. It was kind of a big grandstanding exercise. And ultimately, they made 300 official recommendations. And basically, all of them are like closer integration, single foreign policy, European army, tighter regulatory institute, just the whole predictable.
Yeah, exactly what they do and what they've been doing and what they want to do, what they've always wanted to do.
Well, that's exactly it. There, a British commentator, I forget who it was, on the BBC talked about this very briefly, and he said it's like the European Union called a conference, the European Union hosted the conference, the European Union got everything it wanted from its own conference. Who would have guessed?
Yeah, it's like the thing about when the police investigate themselves and they discover that everything was absolutely fine. Well, the BBC as well. I'm sure the NHS, all of these. Okay. So would you like to comment on that? The EU, is that, I guess there is sort of meat in that, in the sense that we're talking about a very detached elite. You know, we're talking about an institution, a whole network of institutions, really, that are very detached and don't really care. It doesn't matter to them whether, well, what the public wants, how the public feel, you know, it's let them eat cake kind of thing, isn't it?
Well, they got their pretense. They have their pretense to say, well, we invited the public and the public likes these ideas per the conference that we hosted. So we're going to, you know, go forward full steam ahead with these things that we want that the public said they're okay with, which is just not the case. But anyway, you know, they have their pretense now to attempt and kind of steamroll ahead. And unfortunately, without Britain in the EU, a lot of the sort of smaller states that don't want to continue ahead with this, just they don't have any recourse.
Right. See, that's an interesting repercussion of Brexit, that it leaves the less EU happy states within the EU kind of stranded. They don't have that unifying force that Britain.
Well, yeah, they would have Sweden, Denmark, Finland, they had the Netherlands, Austria, they'd all line up behind Britain, and because, you know, Britain's this big kind of behemoth on the continent, and they'd say, well, Britain doesn't like this and we don't like it, and you're going to do what Britain says, and now Britain's gone. unfortunately, in that way.
Yeah, it is. I see it. I can definitely sympathize. And I guess that I just think the EU needs to fall apart. And I think that, but of course, for any of these smaller countries, it would be a really dangerous thing to leave the EU. It really has to be the bigger countries. If either France or Germany were to leave the EU, I'm pretty sure that would be it. It would just unravel. There's no way that it could continue. So hopefully one or both of those countries will decide to Brexit.
Probably France ultimately, but
Frexit. I remember just after Brexit, in fact, I did a set of streams about it at the time. Which country will be next? And unfortunately, we're
probably
6 years
Italy.
On. And, yeah, what was it people were calling it? Italexit or something, whatever.
It's not very, it doesn't flow off the tongue.
That doesn't lend itself to. 6 years on, we're still waiting for the next one. It's a bit disappointing.
It takes time to get there. I mean, the other problem is any other major country that is looking at leaving is a member of the Euro, and the Euro is a bit of a Hotel California. Wanting to leave and being in the Euro is a very tough situation to be in, because basically you'd have to, for a prolonged period of time, you would have to cut your banks off from the rest of the world so that there isn't huge capital flight, as everyone who has any money opens a bank account in Germany and they move all their money there. The euro was a hard thing to get yourself out of, unless, and this is what I think needs to happen, everyone in Europe, at least all of the major countries, have to get to a point politically and be ruled by a political class that's willing to sit down and say, you know, this collective project is over. We're done with attempting this. We're all going to go back to national currencies at the same time in an orderly manner.
Well, absolutely. Sorry, I was looking for the post-Brexit hangouts that I did, and I can't see them. This is really annoying. No, I can't see them now. Okay, so, all right, we'll move on to the next thing, which is, the 27th of May, 1 million foreign nationals granted UK entry. Presumably this is when that news was released.
Yeah, that was the date the news came. I just remember. I remember reading it, and I remember thinking, the Tories never disappoint. And I've sent you this meme before, and I think I sent it on that day. It's like, just go for one day not hating the Tories. And the person's crying, like, I can't. They're all cunts, you know. Pardon my language, you know. It was just one of those moments where you're like, the Conservative Party.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember Morgoth in particular being incensed about this and really a bit depressed about it. Because, it underlines that the Tories are not... It's not a matter of, oh, they're nearly as bad as Labour. They're worse than Labour.
Yeah, this is the thing.
They're actually worse.
We are going on year 14. The 14th consecutive year that the Tories have had in government. I don't think we can keep making the "but Labor are worse. Imagine if Labor was in power." And this is not an endorsement of Labor, but I mean seriously, we can't keep making the "oh well, the Labor Party is worse. Imagine if the Labor Party was in power. Oh my gosh, the Labor Party." No, it's been 14 years of the Tories, and here we are.
Absolutely. They've had 13 years to get immigration under control. They've completely failed to do it. But the interesting point that was made by Morgoth and others at the time about this was that they have different reasons. The Conservatives, right-wingers, the same in America, Republicans, they have different reasons for allowing and wanting mass immigration, which are actually worse than the reasons of the left. I mean, the left have this sort of delusion, like, well, okay, if we're talking about everyday leftists, low-level leftists, they've got this delusion, utopia thing about diversity and how wonderful it all is, and we'll all be happy together. But then higher above them, the higher-level leftists are a bit more, you know, Machiavellian and sick about it. They really are anti-white and wanting to, you know, replace us. But then on the right, it's just economics. It's just GDP. It's it's good for the economy, and our own citizens can just fucking rot the economy. And this is that dreadful autism about economics, which always characterized the right throughout my life up until COVID, when, you know, the lockdowns and all that, when suddenly the economy didn't matter that much because the regime and its strengthening comes first, comes before even the economy. In fact, the economy can be destroyed in order to strengthen the regime. But other than that, right-wingers have this idea that the economy is really the only thing that matters. It's the only thing.
Aggregate GDP is the only thing they care about.
And every issue is judged on how it could affect the economy, and nothing else. And this is absolutely inhuman. And it's what distinguishes, you know, the old right, someone like Tolkien or Roger Scruton, from the modern right, someone like Daniel Hannan, who I mentioned earlier, just a complete and utter charlatan, complete snake, whom I just despise. Because really, all they do, you could say that they care about liberty, you know, individual freedom, but it's always individual freedom to make money. And there's also the freedom of corporations to make money by screwing over everyone.
I mean, only if you're wealthy, right? Because if you're working class, you don't have the individual freedom to make money because mass immigration suppresses your wages.
Exactly. And it invites corporations to just redesign your town, your city, and even your entire country, as we're seeing in Ireland. So, not just Ireland, but that's a good example of it. This is a dreadful mentality on the right. But of course, this is at least as the reasoning that they give for mass immigration. And the Tories, they're doing it again. You know, we're going to get lots of Indians and qualified people from the rest of the world into Britain. That'd be good for the fucking good for the economy. They're going for it again and again, but of course, there is the question of: are the people who parrot these arguments actually in charge of anything, or are they just lackeys? That's a rhetorical question. But the point is that these arguments work on normal right-wing people. The public, they swallow it, or at least they have up until now. I don't know if they still will. I mean, that does seem to be something that's changing, because the effects of it are becoming so apparent to everyone, like the effects of mass immigration.
Well,
rapidly changing that. Yeah.
I don't think you can continue to make an argument about growing aggregate GDP being good for everyone when the GDP grows 8% in a year and wages don't move at all. Like, you can't, people won't remain convinced by, eventually they're not going to care how big GDP gets when they're not getting any of the GDP.
Yeah, exactly.
And their town is unrecognizable, and they can't own a car because it's unaffordable, and they can't pay. They have to choose between the electricity and the gas.
Yeah, and no one can get onto the property ladder. I mean, it's just, it's a terrible way to live. All right, so that was about the Tories and the Conservatives being complete charlatans and traitors, which they are. Let's just assert that. And 1 million foreign nationals granted UK entry in the previous year, 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it should be said that they weren't all, you know, from Africa or the Middle East or whatever. A lot of them were, you know, white, European. So they're not going to, it's not going to have a, I mean, they're not all going to have, drastically alter the country. It's not as bad as it could sound when you say a million people in 1 year. Because it's not a million people who are going to have that sort of effect. But still, there were a huge number of people like that who came in last year. So the point is, the Conservatives just cannot be trusted to protect the border, clearly. And that came back in a very clear way with Liz Truss, that later in the year, when she got into a blazing row with her immigration minister, who was herself of foreign, you know, of non-European extraction, Suella Braverman, she actually wanted to close the borders, cut immigration. And she got into an argument about it with her superior, the Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and Jeremy Hunt, who I think was the Home Secretary, or I've forgotten who he was, his position was. But anyway, the point is...
He manages to find a way into every Conservative government and then find himself in bad graces every time.
Yes, yes. The point is that the party is just hell-bent against having any sort of patriotic loyalty, and certainly ethnic loyalty.
The Tory party, so, Peter Hitchens is exactly correct of two things. Number one is what I said earlier, which is it's just another arm of the neoliberal ruling class. It's not that significantly different. But unlike Labour, which exists to forward the ideological agenda of that ruling body, the Tories just exist to get people into office. That's the only reason they're there. They're not there to promote an alternative vision. It's just, oh, you want to be a member of parliament? You want to be prime minister? Well, the Tories are the party that you join. And they will do and change any position in order to get you there. I mean, there's a great, I forgot who said it, but there's a great quote. Like, if the Tories thought that executing the Queen in Trafalgar Square would get them into number 10 Downing Street, they would do it. That's just how they are.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I agree. It's just complete charlatans, as I said. All right, we'll speed through the rest of them now because we've only got like 15 minutes left. I should have, you know, I'll get better at timekeeping. Okay. Bear with me.
Cut me off whenever you have to.
All right. So the next one is the 14th of June, Canada and Denmark split Hans Island.
Oh, that was cute little one. I added it in there just because it's kind of upbeat. They've been fighting over this island that's like the size of a speck of dirt between Canada and Greenland, and they finally decided after like 70 years to just split it down the middle.
All right, okay. All right.
I just thought it was kind of cute.
All right. And then I think in July, the Dutch tractor protest. Now, this is a very interesting, and again, there will be at least one episode of Millennial this year specifically on this story, this issue. Do you want to say something about it, James?
Well, I will say I was amazed. Well, I think the issue in the Netherlands was yet another one of these tests that they set up to see if people would kind of pass or fail. Because, you know, when you, this is something I've kind of followed in a cursory manner for years. The Dutch already have some of the lowest fertilizer and steroid in nitrogen and in antibiotic in agriculture, they're already at like the bottom of every scale in the amount of this stuff that they use. They have transformed their agricultural sector to be very non-dependent on this. And after doing all of that, the Dutch government then says, well, now we're just going to forcibly buy you out of, I think it was 3,000 farms and close them down, and you're not going to get a choice. And also we're going to make regulatory changes to close another 7,000 after decades of doing everything we've asked. Now we're just going to take them away. And it was just remarkable.
Yeah, it's shocking. I think they wanted to reduce the farming sector by 30%, if I recall correctly, which is at the same time as the Russia stuff is going on. So the wheat and grain from Russia isn't arriving. So, I mean, it just seems absolutely incredible.
You remember the Dutch police shot at one of the farmers in a tractor.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine. Yeah, being a police officer and in following an order to shoot at someone like that,
yeah.
Of all the people to shoot.
Absolutely. And it was a similar thing in Canada with the truckers earlier in the year. The police were being violent with them. I'm not going to say, I mean, I can't remember clearly now what was going on, but I remember them charging protesters on horseback. That kind of thing.
They rode down a woman in a wheelchair or something, I recall.
Yeah, that was it. That kind of thing was going on. And then there was a recording released off police. I don't know if it was their radio or something, but they were laughing and joking about it. You know,
most people who join the police are not good people. I mean, this has been known for a while.
Yeah, it's a cliche about that. You know. Right, okay, let's move ahead. The 26th of August, the Orban government in Hungary releases the Boys in Education report.
Yeah, you shared this one when I wrote about it. This was the pink education report that was written by his government about how catering education so that it only, you know, really promotes sort of the female mentality, how girls behave in school, basically. Obviously, little boys, little girls behave very differently. Little girls are much more prone to sit down and pay attention and, you know, do their worksheets, and boys are more rambunctious and they want to play with toys and they want to get out of the classroom. And it's sort of a trend that education systems are geared toward that female behavior, and the behavior of young boys is viewed as sort of a problem to be solved. In America, they deal with this with ADHD medicine, which is just horrible. But the Orban government releases report, which was written by three women and one man. I mean, it's not like it was just a bunch of cranky old men who wrote this in a room. And it basically said that we have to tailor the education system to sort of promote that energetic creativity that young boys have, or else we threaten the future of our civilization by not having this creative class of people able to express themselves. It was a fascinating report. Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those issues that's very interesting because we're talking about innate human nature.
Yeah.
It emerges, it's apparent at that young an age, and it has very real effects immediately. So it is a very interesting matter. Okay, let's move ahead to the next one, which is the 29th of August, the Scholz speech calling for effective federation.
Oh, yeah. So kind of going on from the Council of the European Council on the Future of Europe, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz came out and he said that European foreign policy has to be subject to qualified majority voting, which basically means that I think it's when 80% of countries representing at least 61% of the population vote on something, then everyone has to follow that. It's called QMV, and he basically called for foreign and defense policy to become European Union QMV matter, which is just it's effective federation, basically.
You'd think that they would get the idea. It's like we said earlier. Like, don't they realize people want to their own nations and to believe in their own nations, to feel comfortable, to feel secure with their own nations, to feel that their nations are working for them, etc. It's a very sort of natural thing. I'm not saying it's the only way that human beings can exist, but the nation state does seem to be one that's very, it plugs a lot of gaps. It's scratches a lot of itches in the human psyche.
Well, this is the thing,
satisfying for them.
You mentioned sort of the artificial creations of the left. It's really only an ideologue who can convince themselves that something as broad as the European exists, that demos is a natural thing that can be captured in a legitimate way. You know,
but they've gone straight, but they've actually leapfrogged the European, haven't they? I mean, they're not talking about, they don't care about Europeans. they're talking about human beings. It's just humans. So we'll get all these Africans in as well.
Well, yeah, that's true. It's just the mass of humanity now, but
yeah. Oh, I see. When you're talking about when it was founded. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you, kind of. The Ventotene Manifesto was written by a communist, and he didn't exactly care about the European either. But oh god, what was his name? Spinelli, Altiero Spinelli.
Right, okay, I didn't know about him. But let's move forward. I'm very conscious of time now. The 6th of September, Liz Truss begins her premiership. This is after Boris Johnson. This is in Britain, obviously.
Liz Truss, the most hilarious premiership in history.
Yeah, and I think the most, was it the second most short-lived premiership?
I think because there was, I think the shortest was like 18 days or something.
Right. Okay. I mean, that was just a ridiculous. I mean, she's okay. Well,
they picked her because the British business class doesn't like Rishi Sunak, which is why I don't think he'll be prime minister for very long. The business class is not a fan of him. And so he is big on. He's sort of really dedicated to the tax and spend idea. You know, he does not like deficits. So he was going to raise corporation taxes or continue with a planned raise of corporation taxes. And obviously the business class was not particularly keen on that.
No, of course not. That's the issue of Liz Truss and all of that will be dealt with later. So we don't need to dwell on it here.
That would take forever to get into.
Yeah, and there is a lot. There's just stuff to be said, but we can say it elsewhere. The next one is the 8th of September, just 2 days after Liz Truss became Prime Minister. Queen Elizabeth II passed away, and Prince Charles became King Charles III. That was and I talked about that quite extensively at the time.
I did too.
Yeah, indeed. And I did a stream with Morgoth on Countercurrents with Greg Johnson about it. It was a very interesting. I enjoyed that stream very much. I would recommend it to people. And it was the end of an era.
It was a requiem of Britain.
Well, yes. There were many different ways to look at it and talk about it. And it's interesting intellectually, but it's at the same time we are talking about real things. You know, it's not just a sort of intellectual wankery.
There was a lot of, and I was disappointed in sort of the broader movement because there was a lot of intellectual wankery in our own circles from people who were trying to kind of make fun of and minimize how upset normal people were. And I found that very distasteful. And I didn't, there was no reason to be sort of grotesque and grug and just sort of generally uncouth about how average people were feeling. You didn't have to love the woman. I'm not telling you to write a sonnet about the passing of the queen, but people were being ghoulish. In asserting that, actually people don't care. No, people did, and a lot of people made nationalism look prickish by saying the things they said.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it was one of those times where if you can't think of anything nice to say, just keep quiet.
Yeah, just
because people cared about her and the implications of her death and the royal family and the monarchy, the institution. People cared about that. whether for good reasons or bad reasons, whether you agree with them or you don't, it doesn't matter. This is something that is meaningful to them.
Exactly.
And so to sort of intrude upon that and cheapen it and make fun of them for it isn't going to win you friends or influence people. It's just going to make you look like a tone-deaf buffoon.
Tone-deaf is a good way to put it. I was very disappointed by the amount of tone-deafness.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as I say, you don't need to agree with them. I actually did agree with the detractors on certain things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's not like she ruled in the way that you want a monarch to behave. I'm not
exactly.
I have no, the point interest is, in defending the legacy.
No, neither have I. I mean, it's really all about being respectful of other people's feelings at the time, but also the meaning of it all, that it's the end of an era. That matters. It really does matter.
The last connection, really, and this is kind of interesting, it was the last connection, the Queen was the last connection of the whole West, the entire West, to the pre-World War II era. She was the last one. There are no other leaders, exactly. There are no other popular figures who are connected to that time before. It's now gone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why it mattered. One of the reasons it mattered. And one of the things that it was a very, one of the reasons why it was a very inappropriate thing to cheapen, because it had such gravity about it. It had such import attached to it. So, and again, this has got nothing to do with her as a person, frankly.
Exactly. Yep, I agree. I completely agree.
Yeah. All right. It's nice to have total agreement there. The 11th of September, the Swedish general election, Ulf Kristersson becomes PM.
Yes. Yeah, so there was a lot of sort of hype around this. The Sweden Democrats, the moderates and the liberals, sort of the blue coalition won the election. They formed a government. And there was kind of a lot of excitement about the immigration promises and, oh, this is a change in the way Sweden's going to behave. And I was like dumping buckets of cold water on that narrative. You can go on my channel. There are so many posts like, no, it's not. They, in like typical conservative fashion, they said, well, we'll look. They signed a coalition agreement. It's called the Tidöavtalet. You can read it, and all of the promises are like, well, we'll consider, we'll research, we'll look into, we will investigate. They use the word investigate, changing this policy or that policy, all around immigration, namely. They made promises to do things like build senior care facilities and more nuclear power plants. But when it came to fundamental social change, oh no, we're just going to investigate. And I was having to remind people, feverishly reminding people, this is not a promise. They are not going to do this. Stop hyping. Stop giving them credit for something they're not going to do. And I would point out that just last week, the Swedish government came out and said they want to get 300,000 people off of residency permits. And a bunch of people were celebrating saying, oh my God, they're going to deport all of these people. No, they want to give them citizenship. Stop crediting conservatives for stupid shit, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. The next thing, the 21st of September, Russia issues mobilization.
Oh, that was I don't think we need to go over it, but yeah, that was a big watershed and kind of how long this war is going to last.
Yes, indeed. The 25th of September, the Italian general election, which resulted in Giorgia Meloni being elected. Would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think it was so funny watching. Even as Meloni made promises not to rock the boat, not to leave the euro, to continue to support Ukraine, to stay in NATO, to support the EU recovery, like she she kept making these promises like, no, I'm not going to rock the boat. I'm going to adhere to the company line. You know, they're still like publishing reports about calling her like LaDuce, the female version of, you know, the Duke.
Il Duce.
Yeah. I can't even count how many times I saw her called Mussolini and the resurrection of Mussolini. They're just like pouring scorn on this woman who's feverishly promising not to shake the boat, which I think is just a great manifestation of how afraid they are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not sure. Do you think that she's based at all? I mean,
oh yeah. Well, so I wrote a post and I said, you know, if she can govern like Viktor Orban, that will be an improvement upon, you know, the last like 8 Italian governments. And I wrote a post a couple weeks ago giving her credit when she decided to not allow refugee boats to land in Italy at all, period. No landings. And I said, look, this is governing. She has done something. The French are furious. The European Union is apoplectic. The NGOs are like screaming offshore. But she actually did do something.
Well, I mean, yeah, I of course. I mean, it's a matter of what else will she do? I'm not trying to pour cold water on it. I just hope that it does continue and she gains confidence. Trouble is, of course, that she does have alliances that raise concern.
She is all big on Israel and yeah. She loves Netanyahu. I mean, it's the whole thing. But so does Viktor Orban, and he does a pretty decent job.
That is definitely true. It's weird. I don't really understand that. But anyway, okay, let's move forward. The 26th of September, Nord Stream. We don't need to talk about it unless there's anything you want to say about that.
No, I don't think so. We all, I think anyone who is intellectually honest with themselves knows who did that.
Yeah. Indeed. All right. The next thing, the 30th of September, referendums in the eastern regions of the conflict. Ah, yes, this was Russia, Ukraine. Yeah, of course. All right. Those weren't taken seriously in the West.
No.
Okay. Then moving forward, the 20th of October, Liz Truss resigns.
The lettuce one?
Yeah. All right. The 22nd, the 25th, Rishi Sunak becomes the UK Prime Minister. We've talked about that. The 1st of November, the Danish general election. Do you like to go into that?
You know, I would say one thing, which is, you know, the Danish Social Democrats retained power, and it's their best performance in 20 years. And the interesting thing about the Danish Social Democrats is they're massively anti-immigration. They have cut immigration to Denmark to a trickle. The prime minister who leads Mette Frederiksen has written a whole book on how immigration is bad for the working class and it undermines the welfare state. It's just a very fascinating political situation in Denmark that you won't find comparably anywhere else.
No, and Denmark is interesting in that way. It definitely is. I mean, I remember a few years ago they had this thing about improving the birth, like incentivizing births. I don't know how many. I know it worked, but I think I heard 4,000 births. That was the number. It seems to ring a bell. But anyway, either way, you would never see that in any other country. So that alone is interesting. Okay, moving on. The 11th of November, the Europol mass surveillance issue.
Oh yeah, I wrote a post. The European Union changed the legislation because Europol, the European Police Cooperation Agency, you know, they don't have their own uniformed cops. Anyway, the European Union changed the rules so that Europol can collect information on individuals, even if they're not suspected of a crime. And then it can share that information with anyone it pleases without having to ask permission from either the commission or the government who the people are the country where those people are citizens of. Europol can just collect whatever information it wants and share whatever information it wants nearly with impunity. And in fact, it's such impunity that they removed the European Court of Auditors' oversight of Europol. I mean, they basically just made Europol so it's able to do whatever the hell it wants. Remarkable, remarkable piece of legislation.
It's incredible. But this does seem to be the way things are going, where we've got this authoritarian state that doesn't want to monitor itself, doesn't want other people monitoring it, doesn't want there to be ways to monitor it or hold it to account. So it's just doing it. It's just happening. As I said at the start about Canada, it's alarming how much there just isn't an organized opposition to any of this stuff that's happening. So anyway, okay, let's move ahead. The 11th, Ukraine retakes Kherson. Okay. And then the 15th, Polish deaths due to the Ukrainian missile.
Now that one is remarkable because, and I put it in the mention briefly, Zelensky has not yet apologized for that. He refuses to apologize for that. He continues to blame Russia, despite the fact every institution has come out and said that was a Ukrainian missile. Remarkable.
I think it was a Russian-made missile.
Yes, but it was Ukrainian air defense forces.
Very strange incident. I mean, it looks like they were trying to frame Russia. Well, I mean, for that missile going astray and killing people, and now that it's been revealed as a framing job, they're just Zelensky's just sticking to it. quite incredible.
Finally,
on the 29th, the UK census data was released. We talked about that earlier, so we don't need to go into it again. So it has been an interesting and eventful year. I wouldn't say it's not been sort of revolutionary in the sense that I think 2020 was, but it's we'll go into it in many different ways in the coming streams. But I'm grateful to James for this summary of the events. I think it's been a good overview.
We've set up many future streams, which was kind of the goal, I think.
exactly. Now, there are some super chats. Siema says, "My opinion, this war is a setup on both sides. It is simply a plan to destroy Eastern Europe because the populations there were resistant to the woke and globalism. They are turning Russians and Ukrainians into mincemeat now. The Poles and the Baltics are next. Putin is ex-KGB globalist tool." We'll no doubt get into that in the future.
I would say that I'm not a proponent of the everything was planned worldview.
Yeah, I don't think I am either. I know that some of my guests are, so we'll get into that. Darby, another important point with the truckers in Canada, the industry there are still over 65% white. A big reason why it was even successful in any regard. The US tried multiple times to do their own convoy, but failed because their industry is much less homogenous. I believe it's in the low 40s, for 40%. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that before. INM says, an issue we must prioritize is more organized subscription-based groups and material on our scene, especially for organizations like White Papers for fundraising. We need funds for professionals in our movement to work full-time while building legal protection firms also, vital to our long-term success. Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure that subscription-based is necessarily the way or the best way, but I definitely agree about fundraising.
We won't get anywhere unless we can pay people a salary.
Absolutely not. And then there was one here. Hinchfoot. There was a young lad in a cape who gave up the fags for a vape, but while prepping for Yule, he took on some fuel and became a nice, cozy shape.
I like that. That's very true.
Thank you for that. That's a nice way to to comment on me being not quite as slim as last year. So thank you for that, Hinchfoot. Now, were there... Heir of Sigma says, sanctioning countries is no... Now, this is what we were talking about at the start. Is no longer as effective post-crypto financial era. Simple as. So sanctioning countries is not an effective weapon in the age of crypto. I'm not sure of that.
I've had the same stance on crypto since it came out, which is that if the state really wants to deal with it, it will. The Chinese have. People are kind of living a bit of a la-la land in regard to that.
Yeah, I think you might be right. But as I say, I wish the guy was correct.
So do I, but it's just not so.
Okay. All right. I think that's all the super chats and the hyper chats, unless I missed any. So if I did, I apologize. But we'll end this one here, and then I'll be back in 10 minutes with Frody of Guide to Culture. And excellent. So that was the first stream. Hope you all enjoyed it. James of White Papers, your links are all over the place, so I hope people will discover you. In the meantime, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2022 and opening the festival with me. So it was a nice way to start. Okay.
Indeed.
All right. Okay. Thank you. I'll be back in 10 minutes. In the meantime, here is one of the outros.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.